From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. What do you get when you give a police scanner an ambient soundtrack? We find out from Eric Eberhardt, creator of the website You Are Listening to Baltimore. Then, in 1841, the free black man Solomon Northup was abducted from upstate New York and sold into slavery in the South. He wrote a book about the experience that was adapted into the film 12 Years a Slave. We look at how this narrative informs our understanding of race relations today. Plus, Baltimore native Martha Shane is one of the filmmakers behind After Tiller. It's a documentary about four doctors who perform late-term abortions in the U.S. We spoke with her about it earlier this year as part of our Maryland Film Festival WIPR Spotlight series. First, the news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock. That's on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming at WYPR.org. Now, on with the podcast.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Several years ago, Eric Eberhardt stumbled upon the idea of mixing the squawk of a police scanner with a soothing ambient soundtrack. The unlikely pairing resulted in the website You Are Listening To. The project has spread to cities across the country, including Baltimore. Eric Eberhardt spoke with our senior producer Matt Purdy last year about how the project came to be.
My name is Eric Eberhardt, and I'm the creator of You Are Listening To. It's a website that basically mixes together ambient music with live police scanner audio. You can listen to a bunch of different cities all around the U.S. and Canada. It's been going for about almost 2 years now. So I originally got the idea to start You Are Listening To on the night that the San Francisco Giants won the World Series a couple years ago.
And for the first time since 1954, the Giants are world champions.
And I had just ridden my bike home from being out and about in the city with friends, and got home, turned on my computer, and I noticed on Twitter that people were all talking about all kinds of crazy, you know, antics going on around the city. People were lighting bonfires and trash cans and trying to turn over buses and stuff. And one thing that kept coming up pretty frequently in the posts on Twitter was that you could listen to live San Francisco police radio on a website, on Soma FM. And I had listened to scanner audio before, but I figured this would be a really interesting night to listen to it. So I turned on the scanner audio, started listening, and it was really interesting. And then after maybe half an hour or so, I got kind of bored and just put some of my music on in the background. So after I had changed songs a couple times, I realized, hey, this is really interesting. You know, I was playing different types of music, like playing some jazz, playing some electronic music, and it sounded really cool along with the police scanner radio. So I wanted to like share that concept or that experience with people that I knew, but it wasn't easy to do because I would have had to explain the whole process of go to this site, find the right music, etc. And so after thinking about it for, you know, a month or two, I came across a bunch of really great ambient music on SoundCloud. And I was able to like put together a really simple little website to merge the sound with the scanner audio. And that made it much easier for me to share it with people.
24 Mazdeep 1, year ID 19020, 1010 at 1600 hours. Year 98 in Caltrans, just 109 the...
I added Baltimore in the second group of cities. The first group was New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Montreal. And then I went back about a year later and added a bunch of more cities, Baltimore, Denver, Minneapolis, etc. Partially it was based on feedback from my listeners, but also just based on my own kind of interests in terms of which cities I thought might be interesting to listen to. And Baltimore, Detroit, Austin, a lot of these cities just, you know, for whatever reason, have some sort of a reputation for good or for bad. Or just for being interesting. And so, you know, Baltimore was definitely on my short list of places that I was curious to hear what it would sound like to listen to that scanner audio.
91, what's going on? The T-shirt right across the street. Yeah, I saw the female, number two female, wearing a green shirt and jeans, black shoes, walking in and out of traffic, almost got hit by a vehicle.
There is a narrative that's happening out there in each of these cities. There's, you know, somebody calls the police department and they go out to investigate, and either they find out that something actually has happened and they follow up, or that it was a false alarm. And if you're lucky, if you happen to tune in at the right time, then you can actually hear something like that, you know, from beginning to end.
Yeah, I have the dancing person. I'm on a Capitol, 2800 block of Washington Boulevard, on foot, walking over towards the dancing person.
I think the interplay between the very smooth and calming music and then the more gritty and dramatic stuff coming from the scanner audio, it's exactly that. It's kind of like that, those two disparate things being juxtaposed together. And I feel like people are in some ways not necessarily expecting that, but they're used to that type of combination from things like police TV shows, CSI or NCIS or whatever, and movies soundtracks, where like the actual soundtrack will be, you know, very minimal and kind of not intending to get up in your face, but then what's happening while you're listening to that music is supposed to be the focus. And so people have told me that, you know, when listening to the site, it sounds like they're listening to the soundtrack to like Heat or Drive or some type of movie like that, where you're hearing what's happening, you're hearing the police radio, but at the same time, like, the soundtrack is more there just to support it and to kind of, you know, set the emotional tone for the whole thing. Even though there's not necessarily a direct connection between the music and the scanner audio, just putting the two of them together, people will start to make a narrative. And I think, you know, maybe that's really where the kind of the narrative of the site exists, is in that play between the audio and the music.
Yes, there's the Marine unit. If you need us, we're down here at South Point, down by the pier. So you advise, we'll be here till 11 unless you need us longer.
Alrighty, I got Lieutenant Pearson should be coming down there to take command of the South Point area.
If you can advise, I've got 4600 block of Pimlico Road for loud music now. There's no complaint.
Eric Eberhardt is the creator of the website You Are Listening to Baltimore. He spoke with senior producer Matt Purdy last year. We've got a link to it on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. On 88.1, I'm Sheila Cass, just ahead, looking from the 21st century at 12 Years a Slave. Stay with us on 88.1.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or find us on Twitter. We are at Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
"12 Years a Slave" was the first film written and directed by a black director, and whose screenplay was adapted by a black writer to win an Oscar for Best Picture. In all, Steve McQueen's gripping chronicle of a free black man kidnapped and forced into slavery won more than 200 awards. It's based on the true story of Solomon Northup and the memoir that he wrote about his experience in 1853. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. In January, I spoke with Dr. Dolan Perkins Valdez, who has written an introduction for a new edition of Solomon Northup's book. She's also the author of a work of fiction about slavery. Wench was on the New York Times bestseller list in 2010. Dr. Dolan Perkins Valdez joined me on the line from Washington, D.C. So tell us about Solomon Northup's book, 12 Years a Slave. When it was published in 1853, was it widely read? Was it a hit?
It was. It actually came at a really interesting moment because Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin had been published the year before, and she had been talking about Solomon's story prior to the release of the book, which helped with the publicity. And as you know, Frederick Douglass's narrative had been released in 1845, and the Fugitive Slave Act had been passed in 1850. So this was a really critical time in the national discussion about slavery. When the book came out, it was an instant bestseller. It sold 30,000 copies within the first 3 years. But after that rapid success, the book sort of went out of popularity, unlike the narrative of Douglas, which continued to remain popular as he continued to be a prominent national figure. But there were about two or three years there where Northup enjoyed some fame and traveled on the lecture circuit with other abolitionists.
For folks who haven't seen the movie, could you give us a quick recap of Solomon Northup's experience?
Solomon was born a free man in upstate New York. His father had been enslaved to this Rhode Island family, but had gained his freedom. And so Solomon was born there and ended up marrying a woman, Ann Hampton, with whom he had three children. He was a carpenter and a fiddle player, and that's how he earned a living. A couple of men approached him about traveling to a gig in Washington, D.C., and he accepted. When he went to D.C., apparently, he was drugged and sold into slavery. He was owned by several different men for about 12 years, until finally a Canadian who was visiting the plantation in Louisiana on which he was working agreed to take some letters Northup had written to his friends and family in the North. And upon receipt of those letters, they were able to gain his freedom. When he returned to his family in New York, he was very, very focused on getting this book done and getting this story out, really for the remainder of his life.
Did the movie stay pretty true to Northup's memoir, the book?
I felt it did. As I watched the film, I felt it stuck pretty closely. Of course, since the film came out, I've heard various disagreements with that. You know, of course, adaptations are a difficult genre in general, but various people felt that there were key critical scenes missing from the film that were in the book, or vice versa. They felt that some of the creative license that McQueen took was not justified. But in my estimation, I believe it was as faithful as it could be.
Was this book published, do you think, for a white audience, for a mix of white and free black audience? Who do you think his target was at the time?
I mean, I think the target of these books were very polemical. They were political documents. And that's why early on they were labeled as anti-slavery propaganda and untrue. But there's no question that these stories that were published not only as books, they were published as pamphlets, etc., they were intended to further the cause of abolitionism. And so anyone who was involved in that cause would have been reading these. I mean, I think it's pretty remarkable that Northup's story sold 30,000 copies. It was also published in England, for example. So he did a very good job getting this story out there. And most of those audiences on the lecture circuit on which Frederick Douglass and Northup traveled were white abolitionists. And so I think that the intended audience would have been the people who had the power to end slavery. And I think they were pretty unequivocal about that intention.
On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning is Dr. Dolan Perkins-Valdez. She's written the introduction to a new edition of Solomon Northup's classic book, 12 Years a Slave. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. His prose style is typical of the style of the day. It's quite florid, quite, I guess we would call it, kind of stilted by modern standards. Typical of some of these other narratives that you mentioned and typical of just literature in general at that time? And do you think that it gained him credibility to write in this style? Did it make people believe him more when he wrote this way?
I really like the language of Northup's narrative. One of the things we have to remember is that he was assisted by a lawyer by the name of David Wilson, who was also, incidentally, an aspiring poet. And I'm sure that Wilson took liberties with the language, and some argue perhaps even a little bit with the story. So I think what historians have really agreed upon is that Wilson does capture the voice of Northup, and they have also verified that many of these details were true and did happen through the record. But yes, the style of narratives at that time tended to be very romantic and sentimental, and that was the vein in which Wilson and Northup collaborated. And many of them, if you read them, have similar conventions of sentimentality. But my sense is that Northup, because we know that Northup had received an above-average education in New York, I believe that Wilson was trying to capture some of Northup's erudition and voice and language. And although, yes, I'm sure Wilson took some liberties, I do believe that a lot of this narrative is Northup's own voice.
In your introduction, you write that Northup allows for areas of gray in his complicated portrait of white Southerners. Does he sort of leaven the horrific acts of these slave owners with stories of sympathetic slave owners? And if so, why do you think he was doing that?
Well, you know, interestingly, some of the critics who believe that the film wasn't faithful to the book say that some of the more sympathetic accounts of white slave owners were not included in the film, and that the film instead focused on the brutality and the viciousness, much to the exclusion of some of the calmer moments. But I do think that in order to be effective and in order to reach his audience, Northup had to really strike a balance in the tone. And I think not just Northup, any of the slave narratives that you see tend to also include portraits of what they call kind and benevolent slave owners whom they'd encountered. So I think that, you know, yes, this is part of the genre. This is part of, you know, how they felt that they could reach people's hearts. But having said that, I think Northup does it a little bit better than the rest. He's very realistic. He counters any sort of complimentary comment about a slave owner by saying, but let me tell you this, even in the best of circumstances, I've never met an enslaved man or woman who did not yearn for freedom. So he's very, very clear in saying that this is not to say that there were ever times when people actually enjoyed being enslaved.
Sure. There's been quite a difference in the reaction and response to the movie from white people and black people. Have you found that to be the case?
I have. You know, these movies, in a way, for example, that Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained did not do, but a movie such as this one, which takes the subject very seriously, tends to engender old psychological wounds in our country. And I think that it provokes a conversation that is actually necessary and beneficial, no matter what the reaction. And I have noticed that, you know, many African Americans have reacted very emotionally on both sides of the coin. Some say, you know, this is a necessary movie, this is a beautiful movie, this is an important movie, and others say, oh no, not another slavery movie. And I think both responses are valid and necessary to the healing of our national psyche. But one of the things that a movie like this does do is it brings up those old wounds that still need to be healed. And it's the reason why the movie has to be made, because those conversations, I think, need to continue and need to be resolved.
Sure. And I mean, with this book and this movie, how do you think that they are going to help inform our conversation about things like reparations or affirmative action or just, you know, general issues of equality in today's culture?
I think, you know, just having the conversation is the start. If these kinds of films aren't made, we're not even having the conversation. And, you know, even though we've had, you know, Steven Spielberg's Amistad and, like I said, Tarantino's Django Unchained, we've had these sort of Hollywood representations, the serious films still don't get made very often. And so I think having the conversation is the first step. And then from there, figuring out what do we need to acknowledge from one another's pain. Because remember, not only do we have the pain of the African-American heritage of being, you know, the descendants of slaves, but also there are many white families that are grappling with the discovery that their ancestors did, in fact, own slaves. Now, we know only 25% of white men own slaves, but still, there are many Americans who can claim ancestry on that side, and it is a painful grappling for them. And so I think a movie like this is even something that can provoke conversations in white families about their own legacies.
Dr. Dolan Perkins-Valdez has written an introduction for a new edition of Solomon Northup's memoir about his experience being kidnapped and forced into slavery. 12 Years a Slave is published by Atria Books, an imprint of Simon & Schuster. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cass. Lots more after a break. Stay with us.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Go to our website to learn more about the segment you just heard, check out our audio archives, or to join in on the conversation yourself. You can also make a pledge to support local programming like Maryland Morning. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Only four doctors openly perform late-term abortions in the United States. One of them, Leroy Carhart, practices here in Maryland, in Germantown. A documentary called After Tiller follows these doctors. In February, we screened the film at Micah's Brown Center as part of the Maryland Film Festival WYPR Spotlight Series. After the screening, we spoke with one of the filmmakers, native Marylander Martha Shane. I began by asking her about the film's title, After Tiller.
So Dr. George Tiller was a doctor in Kansas who provided abortions. He specialized in later abortions, and he was murdered in May of 2009. So our film follows the last four doctors in the U.S. who are openly performing these procedures in the wake of his murder. All of them knew him. They were very close to him. And he actually had a really interesting personal history. He had been in the military for years. He actually was murdered in church despite being one of the most hated people among many members of the Christian right. And so we at first thought it would be fascinating to make a film about Dr. Tiller, but then we thought we might be more interesting even to go inside the lives of the four doctors who are still doing this work.
Going deeper, why did you decide to take on the topic of late-term abortion at all?
You know, it's interesting. We came to this subject knowing actually very little about the later abortions. We felt like it would be interesting to study these doctors because they are there's so few who are openly doing this work, and because they are among the most vilified. And because Dr. Tiller was doing it, honestly. So, but when we started making this film, we knew very little about the later abortions and the reasons why a woman would seek an abortion so late in pregnancy. And so I think it was something of a learning experience for us as filmmakers, exploring the subject just like it is for the audience.
And what was it like, what did you go through with the doctors? Were the doctors eager to do this project with you, or was it a selling job on your part?
It was very individual. As you can see in the film, they have such different personalities. The two male doctors were already very open and out about their work and were already political figures to a certain extent. Dr. Carhart is very warm and mild-mannered. He immediately said, yes, come visit us in Nebraska, no problem. We'd love to hear more about this. Dr. Hearn at first said, you know, I don't see why anyone would want to learn about this story. I don't think you'll find any audience for this film. But again, also allowed us to come visit. And once we met them in person, they were both on board very quickly. But the two female doctors actually took about a year to decide to be part of the film. They had been really close with Dr. Tiller, who never did any interviews. He always said, "It's not about me; it's about the patient." And so, for that reason, they initially said no. But then I think after some time had passed, and we would just keep checking in on them every so often, eventually they decided to let us come to the clinic. And after getting to know each other, they finally agreed as well. So we were extremely lucky to have all four of them, I think, agree to be in the film.
You show us in the film a range of parents choosing to have a late-term abortion for different reasons, ranging from fetal abnormalities to deciding they didn't want to have a child. How typical are these cases? I mean, did you try to find a cross-section of the cases you... Well, first of all, how long were you at these clinics?
How much time did you spend at these clinics?
So we spent about 4 to 6 weeks shooting in each clinic. And then we spent additional time filming with the doctors and their families and at the some of the protests you see in the film. But, you know, it was a fairly representative cross-section of cases that you see here. I think that the women who have fetal anomalies were often, in some cases, more likely to agree to be part of the film. But we really felt from the beginning that it was extremely important to show a wide range. And even when we couldn't get actual footage with a patient, we found ways to sort of bring that into the story. So there's a scene where Dr. Carhart is reading an email from a 14-year-old girl who's tried to self-abort, she's tried to drink to end the pregnancy, she's tried basically everything she can think of and is just incredibly desperate. And that's a patient who we weren't able to actually film with in person, but we felt like the email was a good stand-in and a way to show the full range of cases.
On WIPR, this is Marilyn Morning. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Martha Shane, one of the filmmakers of After Tiller, a documentary that follows the four doctors who perform late-term abortions. The voices in your film are not, by and large, strident. I mean, we hear protesters. We certainly see public hearings, et cetera, where protesters, anti-abortion advocates make the case, but often we see the demonstrators praying. We certainly hear from parents who are making the choice to have a late-term abortion. We hear a lot from the doctors about why they do what they do, but we don't actually get much of a sharp debate. Why did you take that approach?
You know, we decided just to stay away from debate and to focus on the very intimate stories of these four doctors because we felt that this issue is almost always framed as a debate, and it's almost always sort of in the more mainstream news media, it's emphasized how far apart these two sides are, the pro-choice side and the pro-life side. So we thought that by sort of avoiding those political voices and focusing on the doctors and the patients who are really the ones who are most intimately involved with this issue, but also the ones who haven't really been heard from before, that we could just shed a lot more light on this issue and sort of reframe the discussion.
Who do you hope will see this film?
We hope that, you know, our feeling and what we've encountered is that the vast majority of people in this country are sort of in the middle on this issue. They don't necessarily know very much about the later abortions or the reasons why a woman would seek a later abortion. And they may have some political attitudes, but they have a sense of the complexity of the issue. And so that's the people who would like to see the film.
One of the most compelling voices, sort of second-guessing, is Dr. Sella, who tells you that she struggles with the work that she does. And at one point she tells you that she always sees these late-term fetuses as babies. She says, this isn't tissue, these are babies. What kind of reaction have you gotten to that in particular and to your documentary in general?
To that particular line, I think people really identify with that because I think in some ways that's sort of the elephant in the room is, well, when it is this far along in pregnancy, isn't it more like a baby? I think people would ask that question naturally. And so to hear a doctor say that that's her personal experience of the issue, I think it lets people trust her. It sort of opens them up. They feel like you're not hearing just political messaging, the same old pro-choice talking points that we've heard over and over again. We're hearing a more complex view of this. And so that's been really amazing. And then, you know, I think the response to the film has been really warm. And what we hear more often you know, most often from people who've seen the film is that this issue is just so much more complicated than they realized, and that the situations of the patients and the doctors are more complicated. So I hope that people are coming away with a more nuanced understanding of the issue, and that it's pushing people, no matter which side of the issue you're on, to think more deeply about your perspective.
You grew up in Baltimore County, went to Towson High School. Did anything in your upbringing influence you as a filmmaker?
You know, I grew up with my father, who's a journalist, and my mother, who teaches English to foreigners. So I think there was always a lot of interesting people coming in and out of the house, and always a lot of interesting discussions. And I think that probably shaped, you know, it was a good, a positive atmosphere where curiosity, or an atmosphere where curiosity was encouraged.
There's certainly a Maryland element to this documentary, because Dr. Carhart's clinic is in Germantown, and he tells you that Maryland, as his work was curtailed in other states, that Maryland was the most welcoming, legally, the most welcoming place. And then you chronicle the protests and you chronicle what he does. What went through your mind as a product of Maryland in that part of your documentary?
Yeah, you know, it was a total surprise to me to learn that Maryland had these laws that were, you know, relatively friendly to abortion doctors and to reproductive rights. Personally, it was great because we were constantly low on money, and my dear parents let us stay at their house and borrow their car, and that made it possible for us to film a lot in Germantown. But really, it was, you know, it was wonderful to learn that Maryland was so great. And I think one thing in particular was that the police in Germantown, who we covered a lot of the protests there, and the police were always really, really responsive. And I think that was very different than what we had seen in Nebraska, where Dr. Carhart had previously practiced, and also what Dr. Tiller experienced at his clinic, which was, you know, a police force that was very unresponsive to issues at the clinic. So it was really wonderful to see the police in Maryland being so vigilant and really trying to make sure that nothing bad could happen.
So what's next for you as a filmmaker?
As a filmmaker, I am working on two other projects. I'm co-directing a film about a French con woman who worked in the U.S. film industry for many years. So that's sort of a fun project. And then I'm also producing a film that relates to transgender issues in small town America. And then I'm also just getting this film out there. We're hoping to still get it seen by an ever-growing audience.
Well, you certainly have teed up a lot of issues in this film that deserve some careful thought. So I applaud you for it. Thank you. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Martha Shane. She's a Baltimore County native and one of the filmmakers behind the documentary After Tiller. We spoke in February after a screening of the film as part of our Maryland Film Festival WYPR Spotlight series. The film will screen on MPT2 on Sunday, September 7th at 10:30 p.m. You can also find it on iTunes and Netflix, and you can find a link to it at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. That's a wrap for the show today. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. It's produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. Tom Hall is our culture editor. Thanks for listening. See you Friday.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. That's wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Thanks for listening.